The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Love. Courage. Truth.
40 minutes is all you'll have. That's how long it would take a nuclear missile to travel from North Korea to New York City. And everybody you know who lives around you is dead. A matter of seconds, lives are wiped out. That's what happens if a hydrogen bomb would be dropped. In Manhattan, thermal radiation would spread way past Yonkers in the north and as far south as Staten Island. A huge portion of New York City, one of the greatest cities in the world, wiped off the map. Same would happen with Los Angeles or Kansas City. Over the weekend, North Korea claimed to have this capability. As we were packing up our minivans and setting out on Labor Day weekend trips, Kim Jong-un was taking selfies next to a miniaturized warhead. There was a poster in the background. It showed the warhead neatly inside the tip of an ICBM. Then, a few hours later, an earthquake, 6.3 on the Richter scale, was felt as far away as China. Windows rattled in buildings on the Chinese border. It was not only North Korea's sixth nuclear test, it was the most powerful and significant one so far. The United Nations freaking out. They don't know what to do. The entire world has underestimated North Korea's nuclear program. We just said, what was it, 6 months ago? It'll be 2 years before they even have an ICBM. They had one within a week. Yeah, but they're never going to be able to tip it with a nuclear weapon. They had that within 2 more weeks. Now they have an hydrogen bomb. H-bombs are entirely different. The power of the bomb tested on Sunday far surpasses the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I believe, combined. These are city killers. And that is the power that the crazy man with a funny haircut now has. So what do we do now? Historically, a move like this has either brought our enemies to their knees or ignited an all-out war. Because usually we respond with an embargo of some sort, like an oil embargo. And this is what brought Kim Jong-un's father to the table back in the 90s. But will it work for his son now that he has a hydrogen bomb and an ICBM? Or could he react the way Japan reacted to us in World War II? Because it was an oil embargo on Japan from the United States that convinced Japan that they had to go to war and attack Pearl Harbor. I don't know what the president did this weekend. I know he was in Houston and he is dealing with all kinds of problems. But I think all of us, and those in the White House and the Pentagon, we might all be well served by going back and watching the movie War Games. Do you remember Joshua?
Shall we play a game?
This was Matthew Broderick playing a computer game, he thought, but it was a war game with the Pentagon. Kim Jong-un and President Trump are locked in their own game right now. Who is going to blink? In War Games, we found out in that big, hollow room in the Pentagon, Joshua played all of the scenarios and then finally said,
"The only winning move is not to play."
The only winning move is not to play. The only problem with this is that was a movie. This isn't a game. This is our life.
Mm-hmm. It's Tuesday, September 5th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
On the president's plate now, Hurricane Harvey. $8 billion he needs from Congress. He's got to get Congress to move the debt limit. The investigations are continuing on Russia. He's now has Korea. He has another thing he's dealing with, Keith Schiller, his former bodyguard. He apparently is crushed by the departure of this man who's been by his side forever. He's got a lot going on his plate. And then we have Antifa. Do we have an update on Antifa, what happened this weekend?
California is now trying to classify them as a street gang, which is the Berkeley mayor said Antifa is no different than a street gang. However, I totally disagree with that. And that's much, that's much worse than a street gang. But yes, it's similar.
Have you noticed, though, that they're starting to turn? Everybody is starting to turn on Antifa, which is a really good thing. Well, not everybody is starting to. They're slowly coming to this.
When you've lost Nancy Pelosi, though, that is a big moment in your life.
You've lost a lot. Mm-hmm. Let me share something with you. That yesterday we celebrated Labor Day. And do we even know what we were really celebrating? Do we even know that this came from Canada? It's Marxist. It was a union strike, riots, death. And the very first time, we've heard this in every movie. I've watched Air Force One. Mr. President, we cannot negotiate with terrorists. Do you realize that that Labor Day is our negotiation with terrorists? That's the only reason why we have this? In the late 1800s, Americans started to gravitate towards labor unions, and we did it because everything in factories were horrible. The factories and the mines, all of the things that were fueling the Second Industrial Revolution. Unions were needed because people were working 12-hour, 15-hour workdays, 7-day work weeks. There was no compensation if you were hurt on the job. You had low wages. No benefits, inadequate breaks. They were filthy, dangerous workspaces. You want to talk about a safe space? I don't think there was any. And the problem is America went through a change kind of exactly the way it's going through right now, to where it's leaving a whole group of people behind because we haven't figured it out yet. And so in the late 1800s, the Industrial Revolution was leaving a whole group of people behind. And this is where Marxism, Marxist, socialist, the Antifas of the world, this is their sweet spot. Because there is a sense of basic unfairness. And it's down at the bottom. And that is the point that Marxists like to make. Get the bottom to rise up. They want to take the downtrodden, and they want to turn them into revolutionaries who will level the playing field by the redistribution of wealth. It's the same story that's happening today was happening back in the 1800s. So the factory working conditions and the fact that some people were making a lot of money and some people were working 7 days a week and they didn't have anything gave Marxists a foot in the door. And this is where a guy who most Americans have never even heard of, Peter J. McGuire. This is where he comes in. He was living in New York City. He was an Irish Catholic from New York. He was a devout Marxist. Year is 1874. He co-founds the Social Democratic Working Party of North America. That's the first communist Marxist political party in the U.S. He also found something that we all know because we still have it today. He was the co-founder of the American Federation of Labor, the AFL, AFL-CIO. This became the most powerful union in the country. And his goal, stated, was to convert and transform America to a socialist nation through labor unions. So this is sweeping the entire West because of the Industrial Revolution. And labor officials up in Toronto, Canada, invite this guy and say, you got to come up. We have this labor festival that you're going to love. And it's we've been doing it for 10 years now. You guys have to do this. And so McGuire goes up and he loves it. He comes back and he's like, we have to have a parade. Now, imagine you're a coal miner and you're like, you're going to have a what? We've got to have a parade. So he picks the day of the parade as September 5th. And the reason why is because he felt it fell halfway between Independence Day and Thanksgiving. I didn't even know this part of the story. So the parade was a hit. 30,000 plus marchers skipped the work for the day in New York. They listened to speeches. The last thing I want to do on my day off is go listen to a bunch of speeches. But they listened to a bunch of speeches about 8-hour work days you know, how Marxism is going to heal the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then they have a big parade in New York City. It becomes huge and it becomes an annual event. And it catches on all around the country. And the labor unions now are using this and saying, all laborers matter. All labor lives matter. Well, except if you're black or you're Asian or you're Irish, then we don't accept you into the AFL. But other than that, all laborers matter. Did I forget to tell you the Marxist that started the labor unions? Before you build a statue, we should probably tear it down because he was a wild racist. 5 years go by. Labor Day is now an official holiday in 30 states. But they can't get the United States government to declare it a holiday. It's because at that point, we're not declaring holidays as a federal government. States can do whatever you want. It's 1894. And there is a strike done by the AFL that is huge. And it changes the way America looks at September 5th. It was in Pullman, Illinois. Now, if you've ever heard the name Pullman before, it might be because you know George Pullman. You know Pullman, Illinois. Most likely, you know it because of the Pullman train car. I don't think I could tell you what a Pullman train car was, other than it was the best train car made, and I think it was a sleeping car. Well, who's got the money to stay in those sleeping cars? Oh my gosh, it's the wealthy people. So, 1894, the economy tanks, and things get really bad, and Pullman, who is this capitalist who actually has a, from what I understand, has a pretty good relationship with his people because he's done kind of what the Cadbury people did, you know, the chocolate people over in England. And that is they saw that Marxism was not the answer, but they also saw that there were problems. And so Cadbury went and they built themselves a town and they put doctors in the town and everybody who worked there could live in the town. Well, Pullman does kind of the same thing, except his heart's not really in it. So when the economy collapses, he has to lay off hundreds of people. And then anybody who remained, he had to lower their wages. But he also was their landlord. And the landlord side of him was like, I don't care what happened at your job. That doesn't affect me. And so he didn't lower the rent for any of the company houses. This is what opened the door for the Marxists to come in. The evil capitalists can't get away with that. They had to shut him down. So the workers went on strike. And all of the sympathetic railroad workers around the country joined in. And then, just like it does in Berkeley, just like it happens every single time, a Marxist socialist rally turns violent and rioting sets in. They burn hundreds of these rail cars. The unrest cripples the railroad industry, shuts down the railroad, shuts down the delivery of the U.S. mail, and one of the worst, Grover Cleveland, gets involved. He's president at the time. And he decides he's going to send in 12,000 troops into Chicago to break the strike. How's that work out? Just like you would imagine. The troops and strikers, they start to exchange fire. Two strikers are killed. Now, why doesn't President Cleveland have people on his side? Because there was a problem. People were hungry. People weren't looking at reason anymore, and they were seeing people get rich while they were being screwed. It's the only reason why the labor unions were necessary. Because there was a need for somebody to stand up. President Cleveland this is not a good response. And he's now in crisis. And it's also a midterm election year. And the Democrats don't want to lose. So what does Cleveland do? As he's getting ready to pull the troops out, he holds negotiations and Congress rams through a bill to make Labor Day a federal holiday. We negotiated with the terrorists. We said, if you pull out, we'll not only help you with Pullman, but we'll also make Labor Day a national holiday. Of course, we don't negotiate with terrorists, so we're going to wait a whole 6 days after the strike was broken, and then we'll do it. But those are two, they're completely unrelated. The Marxist terrorists had torched the railways. The trains across the country had stopped. And the president delivered his first gift. What we celebrated yesterday was a Canadian idea copied in America by the Marxist founder of the American Socialist Party and the AFL. It was made a federal holiday by a Congress and president trying just to save face and win votes in an election year. And it was the very first of countless bones that the Democratic Party would throw to labor unions over the next century. Oh, by the way, Peter J. Maguire, the Marxist, racist, anti-immigrant co-founder of the American Socialist Party, AFL, in 1901, it ended for him the way it usually ends for these guys. Either in a violent death or going to jail. In 1901, he was arrested for embezzling union funds, stealing from the workers. Because I guess for some people, socialism, it moves too slowly in the redistribution of wealth. North Korea. What does the president do on North Korea? We come back with that next. No, really, no, I don't want to play a game. I don't know if you heard Nikki Haley's speech at the UN. Did you read it, Stu?
Yeah.
It's a little terrifying.
What, did you have a problem with what she said?
No, I actually agree with everything she said.
Yeah.
It's just a little terrifying.
It's like one of those things where we're doing that thing where we just escalate our language and the way we say things. That's our way of attacking.
But it's not going to last long. You can't just escalate the language.
Well, I don't know. Look at the global warming people do it. Like they say, like, oh, you know what? 500 years from now, we are in serious trouble. You know what? It's 100 years. We are now currently on fire. Like that you just constantly kind of up it, and maybe that works.
I think we are currently on fire. The problem is there's going to come a time when you're going to say, okay, so now what? Because we've already said, oh, well, you know what? We're going to come after. And somebody is going to say, well, Mr. President, you're going to lose all credibility if we don't do something. No, I think we should just quiet.
It's worked really well so far. The quietness has worked incredibly well.
The time to do that was then,
before 2006, when they actually came up with nuclear weapons.
Yes,
that would have been good timing.
Yes,
where were you? I'm saying that back then.
I was saying that back then. I don't know if you
I do.
Yeah, you were there, so I do know you were. You remember that.
I was there. They put themselves in this little box, though, right? They keep escalating the language, keep saying they are not going to kick the... We have kicked the can down the road long enough. There is no more road left, is what Nikki Haley said. She says that they are begging for war, which they may very well be, but...
I'm not going to give it to them.
I don't want... I mean,
sometimes I walk past people who are begging for things on the street, and I just don't give it to them. I'm like, yeah.
You're the total wuss who does that every time. I've walked down too many streets with you. I've walked down too many streets to know that you don't walk by beggars without giving them money, and you don't walk by hot dog stands. Those two things are clear.
I think this time I'm going to walk by them. I think this time I'm going to walk by. Here's what she says. I must say, enough is enough. We've taken the incremental approach, and despite all of the best intentions, it hasn't worked. Members of this council will no doubt urge negotiations and a return to talks. But as I have just outlined, we have engaged in numerous direct and multilateral talks with North Korea, and time after time, they haven't worked. His abusive use of missiles and his nuclear threats show that he is begging for war. War is something the United States never wants. We don't want it now. But our country's patience is not unlimited.
Now, when it comes to nuclear war, I think I'm really patient.
I think I'm really patient.
I have very little self-control in my life, but I think I'm pretty patient on
it's
that
like,
one.
It's like, want another hot dog?
Yeah. One nuclear war? No, I'm going to wait on that one. I'm going to wait. I might go swimming, so I don't want to swim with an ICBM in my tummy. She says, the idea, as some have suggested, a so-called freeze for freeze is insulting. When a rogue regime has a nuclear weapon and an ICBM pointed at you, you don't take steps to lower your guard. No one would do that. We certainly won't. The time has come to exhaust all diplomatic means to the end of this crisis, and that means quickly enacting the strongest possible measures here in the UN Security Council. Only the strongest sanctions will enable us to resolve this problem through diplomacy. We've kicked the can down the road long enough, and there's no more road left. The crisis goes well beyond the UN. The United States will look at every country that does business with North Korea as a country that is giving aid to their reckless and dangerous nuclear intentions. And what we do on North Korea will have a real impact on how other outlaw nations who seek nuclear weapons choose to conduct themselves in the future. The stakes couldn't be higher. The urgency is now. 24 years of half measures and failed talks is enough. I agree with absolutely every word she said.
And she's been really solid so
really
far.
Good.
And this is not at all, despite what the media wants to make it into, a Trump problem.
Nope.
This is something Trump is trying to clean up that the last two presidents have screwed up.
The last four presidents.
They got nuclear weapons in 2006. But yeah, go back to Clinton easily.
Yeah.
I've
been saying this. You've been with me the whole time. How long have we been together? Almost 20 years. I've been saying this the whole time. One of these days, Iran and North Korea are going to cross a line, and it will be too late, and all of your options will be deadly. And you won't be able to move. Now is the time to move. They decided not to. We decided to talk. So now what do you do?
So now you're advocating talk, which is...
Well, no,
I don't
now
know what
I'm
else.
Advocating... Now I'm advocating you give... We pour money into nuclear shields. We make sure that all of our allies have a nuclear shield, the best we can come up with. You want it, Japan? We're not going to pay for it. You want it? You pay for it. We'll ship it over. And everybody put, I've seen Star Trek. Shields up. It works. You put the shields up, and because you cannot strike them first. You can't strike first. Didn't we have this argument?
He is definitely trying to goad us into striking first.
Of course he is.
I mean, it seems
because it will not go our way.
Because then everyone will side with them, and it's the only way they can win.
The oppressor hitting the oppressed. That's exactly what they're going to say. And it will sweep the world and we'll be the bad guy and we'll be standing around going, wait, guys, but wait, don't you understand? No, the world doesn't ever understand. Shields up. Shh. Quiet.
The discussion on, I think it was CNN earlier today, talking about what our options are. They came up with two. And I think you'll pick from these and be really happy. One was we go to China and make them cut off their oil supply, right? You mentioned the oil embargo earlier. The idea that they would not get any fuel. They get something like 95% of their fuel from China. So we go to China and make them do it. No indication that China would participate in this whatsoever.
No, China is not going to participate. China is in trouble themselves economically.
Yeah, and not to mention, the response to that seems to be right now, well, we'll stop trading with China, which is not something that
really?
Is realistic.
Really? Hang on just a second. Tell me how that works. Tell me how that works at your local Walmart.
Well, and not to mention, I mean, how many exporters from the United States export incredible amounts to China? Remember, the number two exporter in the world. Only yeah, China's ahead of us. No. So you
this
do that,
is not a good
you
idea.
Put multiple millions of people in the United States out of work
yes.
with that deal, which is a terrible idea.
Hang on just a second. It reminds me of something I heard somebody say once. Oh, if you don't act now, you'll be out of options and all of them will suck. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Right. So we could do that, which there's no reason to believe they would participate
no,
in that.
No, in fact, you have history teaching you that this is the... People don't understand this. World War One, in many ways, or sorry, World War Two, in many ways, was set up by us. It wasn't caused by us, but it was set up by us because we made England choose. We told them to sink their navy so they had no strength against the Germans, and then we appeased, we humiliated Germany. We did. We humiliated Germany. We did not try to be fair in the negotiations at all. Screw the Germans. We let a passion rule our day. We took away the Navy. And then we said, by the way, England, you have to choose. It's either the United States or it is Japan. Well, they chose us because we had all the gold and the power. And that humiliated. And they even said at the time, don't make us choose. That will humiliate the Japanese, and they're all about honor. And then we put an oil embargo on Japan, and Japan looked at that as an act of war. And so what did they do? December 7th, 1941. I'm not saying that we weren't justified or that we caused them to bomb Pearl Harbor, but we set the conditions. That's what's happening now. Let's not set these conditions.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is a great way to think about it. I will say we've known about this for a long time. Well, you're right, we haven't dealt with, you keep bringing up that you've been talking about this for a long time. We really learned about this, I think, first in 1987 in Superman IV, The Quest for Peace, no. where they yeah, I mean, we knew Nuclear Man was a threat. We knew it.
Right.
Did we act on it? No, we did nothing.
Okay.
We sat back and we waited, and, you know, Christopher Reeve tried to warn us.
I have a feeling Christopher Reeve's solution is better than the second solution from CNN. But what was the second possibility from CNN?
I guess if you want to ignore the history, that's fine. They sabotage. We go in undercover. We sabotage their infrastructure, their energy infrastructure, including with potential cyber attacks, which, of course, as we're currently trying to make the case to the world that you should not use cyber attacks to attack energy infrastructure because we're afraid of it happening to us. We would potentially do that there, which is a theoretical possibility, however, very difficult to do and sends an incredibly odd message to the rest of the world as we're trying to enforce this.
It sends the message that cyber warfare can be done, should be done, and is fair. It's honestly, it is the first to unleash a chemical weapon or a nuclear weapon. The weapon of the future is cyber. Shut down the power plants, the power grids, shut all of it down, and you win.
I mean, look, it's already happening, obviously, though, right? We're doing other countries are doing it. We're not doing it outwardly.
Yeah,
we
nobody's
did it in
saying
Iran
it. Yes.
Earlier. But you're right. Nobody's saying it. And I think the bigger question is if we could even do it. if we could do it.
Yeah.
It's not like we can just walk down the, you know, send a bunch of people into downtown Pyongyang and pull this off. It's a closed society. It's difficult.
By the way, there are 38,000 long-term Japanese residents and another 19,000 tourists and short-term travelers in South Korea. After the test that happened on Sunday, the largest ever underground nuclear test for North Korea, the Japanese government began to draft a plan to get all of its citizens out of South Korea. We've never, ever needed cooler heads. We've never, ever needed prayer and decency and common sense more than we need it now. This is the Glenn Beck Program. I'm going to talk a little bit about DACA, the president's next 30 days. What happened when I was down in Houston this weekend, and the things that I saw are just incomprehensible. Incomprehensible. Imagine leaving your house like you did today, and you come back 2 days later because you were going to work and then it started raining and you knew it was going to be bad, but you're going to be back and it's not going to affect you. And you're at work and they tell you, you should go home and get your stuff. You're on your way home and you can't even get to your neighborhood. Now you come back a week later and everything you own is destroyed. I walk into this neighborhood and we're going to just go to work and what's called muck out these houses. The houses you cannot describe. Television does not do this justice because you need smell-o-vision. It is the smell of spoiled food, of sewage, of river bottoms, and mold. And it's, you get near a house and that's all you smell. And house after house after house. We went into this one lady's house and she was a single mom. She had a couple of kids. She had just gotten back into her house that morning. When we arrived, there were very few people in the streets. It was early. Very few people in the streets. We just went into her house. I didn't even know she was the homeowner for a while. You know, nobody's introducing themselves. They just see somebody mucking out a house or an empty house, and you go in with whatever tools you have. You bring a sledgehammer, you bring a shovel, you bring a crowbar, and you just start taking the walls down. And you move all of the furniture out into the lawn. You then just pile things up outside and you start taking the walls down. Imagine that's what it's like. And it's going to be like that for a while in Houston. Some people are up to 7 days away from the waters even receding enough for them to get back to their house. These people need help, and we'll tell you how you can get involved. Hands on, next hour.
Mercury. Love, courage, truth.
DACA is wrong. Coming into this country through illegal means is wrong. Period. Full stop. Both of those things are wrong. That has to be said before we begin any other conversation. Let's start with DACA. No president should ever be able to legislate from the Oval Office, period. And we have to have rule of law. So we should not be allowing people to come into our country. But this requires an adult conversation. What do you do with the people who are already here? You know, this is such a ridiculous conversation because we should be having the conversation of what do we do to stop new people from coming in? Then let's have the conversation of what do we do with the people who are already here? Let me ask you this. Should children, should sons pay for the sins of the father? No. Our Judeo-Christian values say no. However, wait a minute. Yes. I mean, no, but yes, right? I mean, because if they don't pay for the sins of their father, then everybody's just going to continue to come here, and then we just have to accept that the children stay because they don't pay for this. I mean, it's impossible. What are we supposed to do? The argument is, keep it, end it, keep it, end it. Racist, no I'm not. Yes you are, no I'm not. Racist, keep it, end it. It's ridiculous. It's like we have a bunch of first graders running our country. Nobody is addressing the real issue. And here they are. Immigration is broken. Our laws mean nothing. And the president, not this one, but the last one and the one before, they all think they can just make up laws and legislate from the Oval Office. DACA is unconstitutional. The power to make laws belongs to Congress, not the president. Ending DACA is the right thing to do. But it's not the entirety of the conversation. The conversation that we have to have is, what do we do to stop new people from coming in? And what do we do with the people who are already here? The president needs to use DACA as a bargaining chip. Once he says, I'm ending DACA, then the media just starts their circus of, look at the racist and these cute little children that are being hurt by this racist president. And then we get nowhere. This is a problem that doesn't require. This is a problem that demands a permanent solution. It's time for Congress to act. And we need adults. How do we move forward on this issue? How we do it will tell us an awful lot about the kind of country that we all want to be. But hear this. It starts first with two simple ideas. One, DACA is wrong. Two, so is illegal immigration. Welcome to the program. We're so glad that you're here today. We've got a couple of things for you that we want to talk about. First of all, the president's next 30 days are really, really ugly. With everything that is happening in North Korea, I don't know if you saw with North Korea, South Korean intelligence reporting this morning that North Korea is preparing for another missile launch, likely an ICBM, and pointing the missile at the west coast of the United States. It will take 30 minutes to reach LA from North Korea. That's not good. That means that we will have 30 minutes to see the launch, project the trajectory, call the president. What do we do? Try to knock it out of the sky. Decide, do we launch back? What do we launch? All before there's a splashdown in the water, we shoot it, or a hydrogen bomb goes off in Los Angeles. That's not the way I want to start my day. I don't know about you, but I don't know why people even become president. You know, I don't know why anybody would run for president. Every day, they wake you up in the middle of the night. Mr. President, there may be a hydrogen bomb coming our way. Sorry to wake you up, sir, but I don't want to wake up that way every day.
Hopefully they don't whisper things like that to the president. Shouldn't they actually like speak that in full voice?
Well, I don't know. I think I would rather have somebody come in and just ease me into it. Mr. President, it's going to be a great day. Maybe a little cloudy. And there's a hydrogen bomb that may be on our way. it's going to be a great day. It's Tuesday, so you got Monday behind you already. So it's a short week. And it might even be shorter because they just launched and we might all be vaporized. You should get to the shelter, Mr. President.
Maybe they can just kind of work it into his like natural sound sleep machine. Where like you have like the waves crashing on the shoreline. And then every once in a while, it's just kind of a reminder that there could be a hydrogen bomb coming at any
moment. North Korea could launch.
I mean, think of what they did with Japan. They fired a missile not near Japan, over it. They fired the missile so that Japan would essentially see it cross above their airspace, but still above their mainland. Think of if that thing starts coming towards us, we're going to have to at some point judge whether it decides to splash down 30, 50, 70 miles off our coast or if it's going to land on a city. We have to try to figure out whether it's going to be containing a real device or if it's just a test of a missile to see if they could get it over here. It really is. Anything can go wrong with that.
By the way, if you think our president has it bad, and you think our president, we think our president is, Barack Obama, he was almost a dictator. Donald Trump, he's going to be Hitler, you know. May I just show you something that I read as I was reading about North Korea and what we're going to do with North Korea and who's on the other side and it's Vladimir Putin and everything else. I came across a story about the woman who is suspected to be dating Vladimir Putin. Suspected to be dating Vladimir Putin.
What do you mean suspected?
Nobody knows. She was in Italy recently, and she was wearing a wedding band. Now, she's not just suspected of dating him. She is suspected to be his wife, and they suspect they have two children. But there is no official word. Nobody has any pictures. Nobody has any idea. They don't know if he has two children. He doesn't have two children. He's also suspect that he has two children with her, that they did get married in some sort of ceremony, and he's also got a girlfriend on the side. But nobody knows any of it.
Well, he's killed all the journalists that would report it.
Right.
That's a good one. Right. It's one way to control the gossip. It is effective.
When you start to think, boy, we are in real trouble. Man, look how we are. No. Nuh-uh. No.
It's no. Better than that.
It's much better than that. You know, where there's no difference between us and Russia. Yeah. Yeah, there is. Yeah, there is. We see your wife. And we can do stupid things like say, why was she wearing shoes, at the hurricane? Why was she wearing? We can say that. We can see that she was wearing shoes.
I don't know. So the difference between our societies is that we see.
One's run by a killer and one's not.
Well, that and the fact that we know an awful lot about the relationships of our celebrities here and there we don't. Which actually seems like they're winning that battle. That's actually the right side of that argument. I would rather know less about who's dating who and who's breaking up with
who. Yeah, I mean,
it would
be nice if, you know, I don't need to know. Do you need to know anything about Melania or Michelle Obama? I think we would be a lot better off if we just didn't know about these guys.
Yeah, that job, and Melania is doing it right, I think.
I think so, too.
Because she's not getting involved in all this. She's just, you know, like, again, it's not to say that if you're still a person, you get to do these things. But instead have turned that into an unelected government role. where like the first lady is not, you know, married to the president, but is some sort of government figure that opens programs and advocates for things and tries to make giant healthcare solutions and all of the, you know, to me, that's the wrong direction.
And it was the first, we had a female president for a while. It was Edith Wilson, Woodrow Wilson's wife, when he became incapacitated. Nobody knew. She was signing all of the orders and everything else. She was running the country for a while. And then the next one that did it was Eleanor Roosevelt. And she was very involved. And then we had Hillary Clinton and then Michelle Obama. It always seems to be the progressives that, you know, hey, you're getting a great deal. You're getting 2 for 1. No, I barely want the one. So I don't think I need to double down on that order. I think I'm okay.
It makes sense, though. I mean, Nancy Reagan was very involved in drug, you know, advocating for.
No, but there's a difference between policy and I want to help kids read. I think that's good. I'd like to see our first lady, you know, involved in stuff like, hey, I want to help kids read. That's good. I want to make sure kids don't, you know, do drugs. Okay, I'm cool with that. I'm even cool with, I want to make sure that kids have a healthy lunch, just not as a program. Maybe it's just me. Coming up, I'll tell you what happened in Houston and how you can get involved. Also, how come Donald Trump seems to shoot the hostages when he can use them as a bargaining chip? It's a great story in the Politico that I thought was worth raising because I think he isn't shooting the hostages in the DACA argument. We'll get into that here in just a second.
Mercury.
By the way, we do have to look back at DACA for a second and see how far and how fast we've gone. Remember 2014-ish? The standard for whether you were conservative on immigration or you were an amnesty guy was the DREAM Act. That is what everyone, when Orrin Hatch came out for it, everyone was crushing Orrin Hatch for supporting the DREAM Act. It showed he was an amnesty guy. Then Obama gets in and he essentially tries to pass the DREAM Act, which would allow children of illegal immigrants that have been here pretty much their whole lives or came as a child, and it would give them essentially amnesty. And Obama tried to pass that and had no success because the GOP wouldn't allow it. Because if you passed the DREAM Act, you were for amnesty. So then Obama just does it. He decides to just pull the trigger and just say, you know what, screw you guys, I'm just going to do this on my own. It's DACA. And there are elements that are a little bit different, but essentially what he did was the DREAM Act by himself. Of course, everybody on the right is infuriated about that development. That is not something that we're for. So we get very angry. We say we're going to run someone who's going to get rid of this unconstitutional issue, DACA. And we elect Donald Trump, who runs primarily on a, or at least largely on a border hawk strategy, right? We all know about the wall. We all know about his intent to get rid of DACA. So he gets into office and doesn't do it right away. And then you get a little nervous there because DACA is one of those issues where it is somewhat unfair. If you're a person who came here, your dad dragged you across the border when you were 2 years old and he was breaking the law, but you didn't know what you were doing. And now you've lived here your whole life. You're 24. And you might find out even at 20 that you're illegal. You might not even have known the entire time. And now they want to drag you back across the border to a country you don't even ever remember living in. It's a real heart, you know, it grabs your heart. Okay. So this is an issue that's very difficult for people to deal with in politics. But think of how far this has gone. Now, the border hawk president that was elected is giving the Congress 6 months to essentially pass the DREAM Act. They are saying, you know what, you need to do this or I'm going to get rid of DACA, which seemingly is a threat that the New York Times is saying Trump doesn't want to get rid of DACA. He doesn't like the politics of it. He doesn't want to actually do it. He wants Congress to kind of take it away from him. He's advocating that the GOP-controlled Congress pass the DREAM Act. So we've gone from 2014, where anyone supporting the DREAM Act meant you were an amnesty guy, to 2017, where the border hawk president is advocating the GOP Congress pass the DREAM Act. That's happened in 3 years.
I don't understand the problem.
We move really far, really fast.
And we all play the game of defending that position as if nothing's changed. We're all sitting here defending the position of the GOP and everything else as if really, truly nothing has changed within us and our party and our position. It's totally different.
Isn't this the same thing as Obamacare? Repeal, replace, repeal, replace. When you have control of it, how about this? We slide it back 1% and then not be able to pass that. How about that option?
Yes.
That is where we are.
Yes.
They promised so much over this time. And, you know, a lot of us bought it. I have to say that I bought parts of it. I really thought that they wanted to repeal Obamacare, at least a lot of the people there. And in reality, when it comes down to it, they didn't. They keep saying, well, oh, no, it failed by one vote, and they'll put that all on John McCain. And John McCain deserves a lot of blame for a lot of things. But the bottom line was they weren't passing something there. They were passing something to advance to a conversation in which there was no way they were going to repeal Obamacare. In fact, even the right side of that argument, the conservative side of that argument, was the House plan, which we all complained didn't repeal Obamacare.
Well, try this on for size. Congress has to vote on raising the debt ceiling. When were we for that? The max amount the government can borrow is the debt ceiling, and it has to be raised, or so they tell us, or the government is going to shut down. No, you just have to make cuts. The whole government doesn't shut down. It's like, it's honestly, this is the way to understand the debt ceiling is to understand your own finances. We have to raise our credit limit. Or we could sell our car and buy a cheaper one. Or we could get a second job. Or we could move out of this house into a smaller one. Or we could cancel cable. And we could cancel the satellite. And we could cancel, my gosh, you wouldn't cancel the Play subscription. You can cancel things. That's the way real life works. You don't just say, oh my gosh, you know what? We have to raise our debt ceiling. We have to borrow more money or our family's going to be destroyed. And yet, it's the GOP that is now making this argument. And the president said he wasn't going to move on this unless they passed immigration reform and gave him money for border security. Now he's backing off because of Hurricane Harvey. We go there next.
Mercury. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
The one thing that I've learned in the last 2 years is I need to listen more. People really feel invisible right now. And there is no place where that is more apparent than in Houston. I saw people who had lost absolutely everything. I went with Mercury1.org, and we just went to muck out some houses, but also help bring some publicity to these local charities that are doing things and some of these national charities, and to see how we can help and to give them, you know, some exposure on the Blaze and on my Facebook page. But as I'm working side by side with these people in Houston who are... I heard over and over, I'm sorry, but the numbness is wearing off. You can't relate to what is happening there unless you're on the ground. Every single home in these flood areas, the walls and everything inside has to be taken out and scrapped. It's garbage. You have to take the house to the studs quickly, within a matter of hours. You lose everything. Standing in somebody's lawn with pictures of their children and the babies. And I walk into one house, it's towards the end of the day, and I'm going to meet with Team Rubicon, this amazing group of veterans. And I go over to this house. It's a modest house, maybe 1,500 square feet, maybe. These people don't have much, but they live a full life. It's a nice neighborhood. It's a grandfather, grandmother, daughter, and her son. Four people living in this house. And they went to bed the night the flood started. And they knew they were going to get a lot of rain, but they didn't expect to be flooded. And in the middle of the night, Grandma gets up out of bed and she swings her legs over the bed and she is knee deep in water. There's no electricity because everything has been blown. And they don't know what to do. And she screams, everybody up, get up, get up, get up. Her daughter goes to the kitchen where the refrigerator is floating. It's dark, so she can't see anything. And the refrigerator with the floodwaters are coming in at such, making such an impact that it pins her up against the island in the kitchen. So she is jammed between the refrigerator and the island. When I meet her a few days later, her back and the back of her legs are all just bruised. She's screaming, help, help, help. Nobody can see her. It's chaos in the house. Imagine. The grandfather comes out. He's probably 67, 70 maybe. He's an old Navy veteran, a great guy. He pulls the refrigerator off. They get out. Now, when I saw them, it was their first day back in the house. And strangers were in the house. Team Rubicon, just trying to muck it out and trying to salvage what can be salvaged and take the walls down. It's what's happening to every single house on the block. And I walk in and he is standing in the back. And I can see him. He's just broken. And he's trying to be strong for the family. And I walk into the kitchen and she recognizes me. And he's out in the back porch. And I can see him through the window. He's just standing by the barbecue. And he's just lost. And I come in. And they said, I said, where are you staying? He said, we're staying at the Hilton. And I said, are you okay with money on that? And the tears just immediately well up. And I can see how broken this man is. He says, I don't know. I don't even know how much it is yet. Their systems were down. But I've heard that it's $150 a night and we don't have that. Houston needs your help in a couple of ways. First of all, if you can donate anything, please go to mercuryone.org. We have several partners on the ground, and we are doing our best to make sure the money goes right to where it needs to go, to the best partners. I'm going to introduce you to one of them here in a second. But the second is they need volunteers. I mean, for several weeks, they're going to need people that are just mucking these houses out and just looking at strangers in the eye and saying, you're okay. Because in America, we have a problem with listening and seeing. The people in Houston need to know that they are heard and seen. One of our partners on the ground in Houston is this great organization called Team Rubicon. Jake Wood is the CEO. He served 4 years in the United States Marine Corps, deployed in Iraq in 7 and 08. He was sniper school, top of his class, and now he is organizing veterans to come and do exactly what I'm talking about. And you were there, Jake, at that house. How were they towards the end of the afternoon and evening? Did they ever come kind of back to a place to where just not despair?
Well, Glenn, thank you for having me, and thank you for the support you've provided Team Rubicon over the years, Mercury One. You know, I was sitting there and I was listening to the story that you just recounted about when you came to that home and met with Jim, the grandfather. You know, I would say that, unfortunately, that family is still suffering from a bit of shell shock. You know, I think in the initial days after the storm and after the flood, they were still a little bit numb, as you said. They could kind of walk around and not really process the enormous emotional event that they had just experienced. But, you know, over the last couple of days, it was clear that things were really started, that the adrenaline was starting to dissipate, that the walls, you know, the walls within them were coming down a little bit. And, they got a long road ahead of them.
When you go, Jake, to these houses and it's television does not do it justice. When you walk down the street and everything that somebody that was their life, from their clothes to their underpants to their diplomas to literally family photo albums, all just wrecked and piled up on the street next to their washer and dryer and refrigerator and whatever, you realize there's nothing left and how big the job is, because you have to go in and take down the walls and dry that place out. Take out all of the walls, the carpets, everything in there before it's a deadly situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's really shocking to see just how destructive water is. I mean, I had myself a very emotional experience. I went in and was able to go and help the mother of one of the Marines I served with who took his own life a few years ago. And, mm-hmm. you know, we prioritized her home and we went in there and really we were only able to save a handful of things. And among them, thank God, were, you know, the flag that his coffin was draped in and the medals that she had put in a shadow box. But, you know, those, everything else she can replace. You know, those are the things that would have broken her heart for the rest of her life had they been destroyed in that event.
So when we were out on lawn and you guys took a break and we had just come from another house where we were working all day and we stood there and I said, this is just going to go on and on and on, just looking at the enormity of it. And you said, we have 48,000 veterans that are part of Team Rubicon, and we need to get them on planes to come down to Houston. Can you tell me, A, what you need, and then let's talk about American Airlines and what they've done?
Well, sure, absolutely. Yeah, as an organization, we've got nearly now 60,000 volunteers across the country. I mean, the ranks are just swelling. These are men and women that, you know, have served our country before, that have been trained by taxpayer dollars, that have service as part of their DNA, and they want to come down. They want to help their fellow Americans in Houston. Obviously, we're going to be mobilizing every Texan that we have in our ranks to help them help themselves. But this is an immense event. We're going to have to bring in people from all across the country. So we're doing just that. We're looking to charter aircraft in 10 major American cities. We're looking for an airline partner. We're having great conversations with American Airlines. I think that they may be willing to step up here and help us. And we're really looking forward to that conversation. And I think it'd be an incredible story to tell how an American corporation used what it does best.
Yes.
To help us help others.
Well, I will tell you this. When we got on the plane to come back home to Dallas, we were talking about it, and fuel for those planes is a fortune, and no one company can afford all of it. And if they're supplying the planes and the pilots and everything else, Mercury One would like to try to help and defray some of the cost of the fuel if they're chartering. Maybe we can help pick up for the fuel if one of the airlines would do, you know, what they do. We'll try to raise the money for the fuel, and then you guys get all of the veterans and get them on these planes. So do you send out alert? Can somebody, if you're just a vet and you want to help, what do you have to do?
Yeah, so you can go to our website, teamrubiconusa.org. That's teamrubiconusa.org. There you can sign up and register as a volunteer. We've been sending out mobilization notices across our entire volunteer base for the last 7 days. Again, this is an event that is stretching us at our seams. We need to have all hands on deck. We need everybody we can get. And any help that people can provide to drive resources, whether that's time, whether that's their talent, whether that's their treasure, we can take it.
I'm really impressed, and we're so happy to be one of your sponsors with Team Rubicon. You have 48,000 veteran volunteers around the country. This is your 200th service project, if you will, or a disaster. Rank this out of all the disasters. You guys have been at Katrina, you were at Sandy, you've been in Haiti. Rank this.
Right. I think the earthquake in Haiti was probably the single worst devastation I've ever seen, and 200,000 people died in the first week and a half of that event. But as far as it goes on American soil, this is the most widespread, indiscriminate damage and devastation we've ever seen. And this is a major event. The long tail effort that will be required to recover from this, in the next 18 to 24 months, is going to be, I think, unparalleled. It remains to be seen. We still don't even know the extent of the damage or how it compares to Katrina. But make no mistake, there's a ton of work in the next 2 years, and 10 years from now, there will be communities that still are not the same because of Harvey.
Thanks, Jake.
That was Jake Wood, CEO of Team Rubicon. You can follow him on Twitter at JakeWoodTR. Jake and Team Rubicon are trying to deploy 1,500 volunteers to Houston right now. Get involved, go to teamrubiconusa.org or make a donation, mercury1.org.
So Harvey has dumped an estimated 27 trillion gallons of water on Texas and Louisiana. We won't know the full extent of Harvey's toll on the economy for some time. By the way, is anyone else following Irma?
It looks worse in some ways. I mean, looks like it's going to hit as a Category 5.
Did you hear that they are now thinking that this may be the first Category 6 of all time?
I didn't know there was a Category 6.
There is not one. Right. They're saying now that they have to upgrade. It's going to be stronger than what a Category 5 is, and they may be inventing a new category for this one.
I read they're saying some parts of Puerto Rico will be out of power for up to 6 months. They think with this storm.
So that's just if it hits Puerto Rico. Imagine if this hits Florida or comes back into the Gulf. This economy is already going to take a hit. And I was talking to somebody Sunday night, went over to their house, and we were talking about the events of, the times in which we live. And he said to me, it just feels different. Something has changed. Yeah, it has. The world has changed. And I think we're headed for real trouble.
Mercury.
have to tell you, we have nuclear weapons possibly headed our way. We have the cleanup from Harvey. Washington is a mess. And Irma coming in. And yet, I'm surprisingly okay. This should be interesting. We're going to show you something really positive and a way for you to roll up your sleeves and change somebody's life that fast in just a minute.
Mercury. Love. Courage. Truth.
Scavengers are now stealing from flood victims in Houston. We have seen the absolute best of humanity during the rescue phase of Hurricane Harvey. Saturday, I saw signs of the worst. I saw scammers. I saw a sign in one neighborhood that said, looters beware. This is Texas. Scumbags are starting to rear their head, as they always do. It's really an unreal idea. People returning to their ravaged homes, sifting through what's left of their life, putting things out in the yard to dry, and then have somebody come by and steal from them. This is really rare in Houston compared to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, but it's still early. It's a reminder of how much still hangs in the balance for Southeast Texas. On Sunday, the mayor of Houston said, I'm encouraging people, get up and let's get going. This is the kind of can-do American attitude that really lives. It's the reason why I moved to Texas. I told you when things get tough, we need to be surrounded by the people who kind of feel the same way you do. Just get up and do it. The Washington Post ran a story with the headline, Texans Do-It-Ourselves Rescue Effort Defines Hurricane Harvey. This has been a big part of the story, if not the biggest part of the story so far. The Texan resilience and independence. Neighbors having each other's back. Now, can this last through the rebuilding effort? Because the damage is now between $150 and $180 billion. The question is, can a state with no income tax be a model for a different kind of recovery effort? On its own, through innovative private and public partnerships, without waiting for the money from the federal government to back up to Houston. Do you remember all of the FEMA debit card abuses and swindles after Hurricane Katrina? I'm sure Texas is going to have its share of it. But federal dumps of money is not the efficient solution. Besides, I don't know if you know this, FEMA is still $25 billion in debt from Hurricane Katrina and Sandy. $25 billion in debt. Federal government can't afford this. What do? Print more money? I think this is the perfect opportunity for the governor of Texas and President Trump, the businessman, to outline a different path for rebuilding, for more private donations and less federal aid. Trump was in the real estate business. He was in the construction businesses. Anybody can figure this out. This is his wheelhouse. And this is an opportunity for President Trump to lead and make his mark. Lead and become a unique and find a better way to lead as a president and find a responsible rebuilding, a pathway to a new and better tomorrow in Houston.
It's Tuesday, September 5th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
So you're 21 years old and you think you're invincible. I remember being 21 years old and thinking, never going to die. Now every day you get up and you're like, it could be today. You're young, you're healthy, you have your whole life in front of you. And that is what Katie thought. She had no idea that anything was wrong with her until she went in for a routine ultrasound with her with her second child, Willow. And during the ultrasound, it was discovered that Katie had cervical cancer. And the doctor said, you have to abort your child. You're going to die. Child's going to die. She said, I won't abort my child. She had to start treatment right away. And the answer was, no, I'm not going to kill my child. She was determined to meet the angel that she says saved her life. If it hadn't been for Willow, she would have never known she had cancer. Katie carried Willow to term, and the doctors were able to remove the cancer. Katie was ecstatic. She was cancer-free and mom to a beautiful baby girl. And then trouble set in. Willow stopped eating a couple of months in. The little girl was rushed to the hospital, stayed there for most of her first year. She dealt with pneumonia and heart failure and respiratory failure as one thing after another, weeks and weeks of testing. And finally, she was diagnosed with a rare terminal condition called inclusive cell disease, which inhibits growth and breathing and heart function, digestion, everything. There were only 72 confirmed cases in the world. And despite her ailments, Willow was finally released from the hospital just in time for her first birthday, and Katie was excited to finally have Willow home, where she could give her the support and love she needed most. While preparing for her birthday, Katie encountered another blow. She became the victim of domestic violence and found herself now a single mother of two young children. The reason why I'm telling you this story is because there is a remarkable person inside mom. Because Katie hasn't lost hope. She is now doing her best to provide for her son and Willow all on her own. And she says, I am not going to let Willow down because Willow saved my life and now she vows to save Willow's life. Katie joins us now. Hi, Katie. How are you?
Hi, thank you. I'm good. You?
I'm good. This is a remarkable story.
Thank you.
How is Willow?
She's doing great. She's still snoozing right now. She loves her sleep and loves to sleep in. So.
And she spent in her first year. She spent all but 12 days in the hospital.
From November 18th of 2016 January 16th to November 10th of 2016, all but 12 days was spent between our tiny hospital back in Montana and Seattle Children's Hospital.
So, Katie, what do you say to people who will make the case, and I'm sure they've made it to you? They'll make the case that, see, you know, you would have been better off. She would have been better off had she never been born. You know, I could imagine people have even said, you know, God intended her. You were supposed to do that. That's why she's suffering from all of this, even though you didn't know. How do you respond to that?
We've gotten a lot of it and stuff, especially with the articles going around. There's always those people who are like, why bring a child into the world knowing you have cancer, that your cancer is going to affect them, or knowing that something is wrong with your baby, and so on and so forth. And I take it as an educational moment because, one, my cancer did not affect Willow in any way, shape, or form. Cervical cancer has no way to affect an unborn child. Also, cervical cancer cannot cause a genetic mutation, which is what Willow has. And with iCell being so, so, so rare, obviously most people in the world are not aware of it, and most doctors do not even know of its existence. There is no way to test for it in the womb unless, say, I had another child. Now we know Willow's exact DNA mutation. We would be able to check to see if that child also has that exact DNA mutation. But when it's your first go-around with a child that you've never had, you know, you didn't have a previous iCell child, you're kind of in the blind of all of it. Willow was extensively monitored. She was very healthy. She developed totally normal and stuff. So, I mean, people call me selfish for not aborting and stuff. And I'm like, calling me selfish would be calling every other woman in the world selfish, because we all put our children at the same exact risk while they're in the womb. There's over 7,000 other rare diseases and stuff that most of them cannot be detected until well after your child is born.
Had you known what Willow is going through now, would your answer have been different?
I don't think so. I mean, I would never judge on somebody else's choice of whether they keep or abort their child and stuff. But for me, that's just, it's not in the cards for me. I don't think that I could bring myself to do that. I believe that every life out there has a very divine purpose and stuff. And I believe that God gave me Willow exactly when he knew that I needed Willow, knowing the contents of my heart, that, you know, I would go through to see her life happen and stuff, and that, then I would be there when she would need me and stuff. Like,
and when Willow is not expected to live possibly past 10?
Yeah, prognosis, medical prognosis at best is 10 years old. There have been a few, very few kiddos with this that have made it shortly past 10. But the average span of these kids is 3 to 5 years, because there is no treatment at all whatsoever, because there's so little funding happening. There's no government or federal funding like there is for cancer researches and that kind of thing. That doesn't happen. All the research funding comes directly from, you know, the few families that have been affected.
Katie, I will tell you that I'm from a family that has a long history of abuse, and I I commend you for getting out, especially in your situation with two children. One of them is severely sick. A lot of people will convince themselves that they either deserve it, or it's the pressure on him, or, you know, whatever the excuse is. How difficult was it to make the decision, or was it strangely for you just obvious?
Well, I mean, it was, we were kind of in this situation for a while. Like, once Willow started getting sick, unfortunately, her father, because of the way he grew up, the only way he knew how to cope was to have alcohol to drown out everything he needed to cope. So it was going on for a while. I had repeatedly tried to find him help, get him help, and stuff. Like, he would start seeing counselors, and it would get better, but then, you know, he'd push off and fall back again. It's really true what they say when, you know, they say you can't help somebody who doesn't want to be helped. But after her terminal diagnosis, it really spiraled for a while. But after she came home, it seemed like things were getting better and stuff. Like, we got into a routine and everything. I think probably because he hadn't drank in a while even, but I think what psyched it was, you know, that, you know, it was Willow's birthday the next day. And even though every birthday, just like for every family, is a huge milestone and, like, it's very exciting, for us, it's also extremely, extremely bittersweet. And so, because we know that we're not going to have very many of them. So I think that kind of got to him, and that's what stemmed his drinking after work that night for when he came home. And, you know, I don't hold any bad blood for him, because none of us know how we're going to cope with something like this. You know, none of us can say what's going to happen or how we're going to handle a situation like this until, you know, we're on the front line of it. And we all have different coping mechanisms. That doesn't mean that what he did was okay and that there's any excuse for it. But once things became physical and once things posed risks to my children and stuff, again, like, my life, it's for my children. Just like when I was pregnant with Willow, like, I will not let anything in the pathway of harming them. So when it became...
Go ahead.
Yeah, it was... When it became physical, it was, you know, at that point and stuff, like, Easy. Obviously police were called and he was removed from the house. So, and since then, we haven't had contact with him.
When I saw your story online, Willow is dependent on 24/7 feeding tubes. She's on heart and oxygen monitors, yes. Medication from 6 to 10 p.m., BiPAP at night, requires what is called deep suctioning, threading of suction catheter through her nose and the airway. Oh, this is so, so harsh for you. You list all the things that you have to do. And now that you are out, you can't go to a shelter because,
no.
You can't bring Willow into the shelter. She gets a cold and she can die. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've been accepted on a housing wait list, which you said could lift our biggest stressor from our shoulders. And the list is long and we're close to the end and not likely to receive some help until some point in next year. We're just doing all we can for roof over our heads. You had a goal of $5,000 and you were, last I checked, you were at $2,900. Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem like an awful lot of money to be able just to keep the roof over your head. It seemed
it's
like
not. It's not. But I'm one of those people, I have a very hard time asking for help as it is. And like, I don't really set my goals too big because I don't want to be disappointed. And I don't want to come off like, you know, I'm asking for a handout. Like, you know, I'm asking the world of people. That's not the person that I am. So.
You're remarkable, Katie. You're remarkable.
Thank you.
And I applaud you for your strength and expect miracles because they will happen. Thank you,
Thank
Katie.
You.
God bless.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, can we change her life?
Yeah, really cool chance to do something for somebody. Katie Hansen and her daughter, Willow Ray Porter. They're up on youcaring.com. Actually, let me send it right now. Just posted on Twitter at World of Stew if you want to donate and help. I mean, she only needs a couple $1,000. This audience can do that.
Let's
in like 9 seconds.
Her life. Did you hear her, the way she spoke about, I don't want to ask for help? I mean, holy cow, let's change her life. We just tweeted how you can help. Join us on that, will you? Can you give the address again if you want to help Willow and Katie Hansen?
Well, it's youcaring.com, but if you go to @worldofstew or @glennbeck on Twitter is probably the easiest way to get to it. And it's the money's coming in already, and hopefully we can actually change their life. I mean, she's almost to her goal already.
I mean, imagine
about 3 minutes.
She's a mom, a child who, if she gets a cold, she dies, and she can't go to a shelter, and she's out of a house because she left an abusive relationship. I mean, and she's not. She's so humble. That's why we put her on the air. She is just, this is not her. She doesn't want to ask for help. I just think it's a fantastic cause. If you would like to help her out, you can. DACA is probably the big news today. President Trump has reversed DACA and said the Dreamers program is over and is pushing it over to Congress and saying, you got to do something.
Right. So they're encouraging the GOP Congress to pass something similar to DACA, but they're saying they don't like the way it was put in, which is completely unconstitutional in my view. So I'm glad they're doing that. The reporting is that Sessions really wants this done. Trump doesn't like the politics of it. So he's hoping that the Congress will kind of come through and pass this so they don't have to deal with it. It's also, the details of it are interesting in that new DACA applications that have been received as of today on a case-by-case will be reviewed as a case-by-case basis. So they're not just going away. They still have a case-by-case basis. Anything that is in process already will be processed as usual. Anyone who has it now can renew for multiple years, and they are not taking it away from anyone who has it now. So everyone's going to present this as really hateful, but they're very lenient in the way that they're doing this.
Protesters are already filling the street in front of the White House. This is a PR nightmare for the president and for the GOP.
Mercury.
Mercury. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
So we have Congress working on ways to a path to citizenship for the Dreamers, which I believe is what got everybody off the stage in the GOP in the first place during the election. But now the GOP is working on that. The DNC is, of course, saying that President Trump is heartless on the getting rid of DACA. Whew. Pat is starting his own broadcast on this network, on the Blaze Radio Network, starting, what, Monday?
A week from yesterday.
Yeah, a week from yesterday. Mm-hmm. Pat was the number one host on KPRC in Houston before I dragged his butt to New York City to help me with the Fox thing and everything else. And I am you can read my Facebook post from last night. I am figuring my entire company. As you know, if you're a regular listener of the program, I took control of my own company about 4 months ago, 6 months ago, something like that, and started to do my own homework on exactly what was happening and how we're doing things, and then looking at the future and seeing what is happening in conservative media. And then I started listening to you, and we need to start to really listen and respond to you. And one thing that Pat does really, really well is respond to things perhaps with a little more vigor than I do at times. And so he's going to be on the Blaze Radio and TV immediately following this program, starting a week from yesterday on Monday. And it's a 3-hour broadcast, and it is one that you don't want to miss. We're internally, we've been just calling it Pat Unchained. There's no more a Glenn stake. The chain has been unstaked, and so we're letting him loose starting on Monday. So what have you been thinking this weekend?
So I'm sitting in church yesterday because I'm not unleashed quite yet.
There's still a little bit of a leash.
Yeah. So I'm trying to stay awake in church, bobbing off. And this young woman gets up and she starts talking about a blog post that her friend in Houston wrote. And she shared this post and I thought, wow, that's everything we've been saying for the last year. So I thought I'd share part of it. It's called The Good Thing That Hurricane Harvey Washed Away. There's not much in the world that I can truly say I hate, but I hate Harvey. We've been sitting here for more hours than I can begin to count, being brutally lashed by this seemingly never-ending fury. I would be lying if I said it wasn't scary, terrifying at times, but we're among the lucky ones. We are safe and dry. Harvey has taken so much from so many: homes, lives, hopes, jobs, all washed into the Gulf of Mexico by his relentless anger. Pregnant women and their toddlers stuck on roofs waiting for hours upon hours for help. A friend with 7 feet of water in her home swimming for her life to a rescue boat. An elderly couple trapped in their attic with rising water. A man drowned as he clung desperately to a shopping cart in a parking lot. Thousands stranded, thousands homeless, hundreds in need of rescue. No water, no food, no end in sight. My heart is bleeding. Yet, in the deluge, there is something incredibly beautiful emerging. You see, Harvey has washed away something else. Hatred. Mm. The only color in greater Houston today is red, white, and blue. The only religion on our streets is love. There's no race, no creed, no gender, no socioeconomic classes, no nationality, no sexual orientation, no religion. There are only people helping people. There are only strangers opening their homes for strangers. There are only men and women risking their precious lives for other precious lives. Today, no matter who you worship, no matter the color of your skin, no matter where you were born, we're all Texans. For a stunning moment, the world has stopped fighting against each other and started fighting for each other. It's breathtaking. Take note, world. You don't need to wait for a devastating disaster to love. You don't need to wait until your neighbors are drowning to reach across the color, religious, nationality, political boundaries. This world is suffering a different kind of storm, one far more dangerous than Harvey, a storm of hatred. Let's refuse to let it break us.
I will tell you, that is the spirit that I found on the streets. I was there Saturday, and we were the first plane, I think, to land in Galveston, and we were the last one out on Saturday. And we brought in, I don't know how many tons of water and everything else. And we went, and I brought the family because we wanted to actually serve. And we were mucking houses out. And people were like, oh, I don't see Glenn working. Yeah, because I didn't have them film my family and I doing service. But what I was amazed by is, as we're mucking out one house, we're standing there and we're taking a quick break, and it's about noon or so, and the homeowner says to somebody else, you know who really has it bad? Now, I'm thinking you. I'm standing there with a woman who has just dumped every photo album, all of her baby pictures with her kids. She, by the front door, she's just kept a chair with a couple of things that she could keep, and one of them was a couple of photos of her children and her in her wedding dress, and that's it. And all of the other photos have all been destroyed, and they're just dumped out onto the lawn. She's, everything's gone. And she says, you know who I really feel bad for? No, who? And she said, the couple across the street. Now, their house looks exactly like her house does. And I said, why is that? And she said, because they're older than I am. I can start over. I don't know how they're going to mentally make that gear shift. I feel so bad for them.
Mm.
So I go over and I'm talking to them. And they say, and I'm not kidding you, you know who really has it bad? And I'm like, yeah, the lady across the street over there. They said, the couple across the street. They pointed to another couple across the street. They've had a really tough go of it lately and blah, blah, blah. As I'm leaving, the couple that the second couple pointed to, the third corner, okay, they come out, they recognize me. I'm getting into the car. I didn't even know they were in the house. They come out. Everything is out. And they said, Glenn, can we talk to you for a second? I said, sure. Now, go on my Facebook page and watch it. I just wrote something like, for those of you who don't believe in America or the goodness of neighbors, just watch these people. Can we talk to you for a second? I said, yeah. They talk about what life is like for them and what's been going on. And then they talk about how hard it is for everybody else, but how grateful they are because everybody's just pulling together. When they said, can we talk to you for a second? I said, sure. I didn't bring out the iPhone. I said, sure. And they said, can you please get the word out? Because some of our neighbors are really having a hard time. They're not going to be able. We can do this, but they're not going to be able to handle this mentally. They just are so. These people are amazing.
Yeah. This would probably be astounding to some people, but not to me, because I lived there for 8 years. And even when there's not a disaster, the people of Houston are phenomenal. And that's why I fell in love with that city. And that's why I love it to this day. But especially when there's something going wrong, they band together. And that's why that article we read a couple weeks ago from the
Salon
is just so aggravating, because we did see the best come out in human beings in Houston. And we continue to see it, and it's happening every single day, every minute of every day. And the worst is probably still not behind them. I mean, they've got a cleanup of years here.
I was in Friendswood. You know where Friendswood is? Okay, so I was in Friendswood. That was hit the hardest for rain. Okay, that was the one that got the 51 inches of rain. Mm-hmm. These people left. One of them said to me, they left to go to a movie. They get out, they start driving home, and they can't get to their house.
Jeez.
I mean, and that was the first day. That was Saturday, was the first day they could get back. And these guys were telling me, oh, no, there's parts of Houston. The water's still coming in. They won't. They're not expected to get into their houses for 9 more days.
Can you imagine? I can't even imagine that.
Have you ever cleaned up after a hurricane?
Yes.
I never have. You will never forget the smell.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
You can't even begin to relate. You can't even begin to relate. This is why earlier today we asked you to do two things. One, if you can donate money, go to mercury1.org. The money is being deployed. I was there, you know, holding up the arms of some of the people who are doing the work on the ground and making sure that, you know, we're doing everything that we can to help. I was there on Saturday, and Mercury One has amazing partners on the ground. So if you can donate, please do that. If you can donate your time, especially if you're a veteran, Team Rubicon is this amazing veterans organization that has a whole bunch of people that are already members, but they need to be activated. And we're trying to raise the money and get the airlines to be able to give free tickets, or we'll reimburse, or we'll do whatever we have to do to get all of these volunteers down. But we need some heavy lifting people. We need some backs, and we need some arms, and we need some hands.
Yeah, it's TeamRubiconUSA.org, I believe.
You say that with such confidence.
Well, because you just looked at me like I was supposed to know it off the top of my head. I threw the piece of paper out 2 hours ago. Yeah, I will say this, though, Pat. I do have one important question. The most important question, which you have not answered, which is, did this incredible story from Houston keep you awake at church? Did it succeed?
It's the thing that woke me up.
Okay, and good. Wow.
Yes. That's enabled powerful. Me not to plant my head into the bench ahead of me.
By the way, you can catch Pat's show beginning Monday on the Blaze Radio Network following this program. Pat Gray is joining us. We were just talking about Hurricane Harvey in Houston, and now Irma is making her way, and it looks, I mean, I'm not a sports guy, but I think it's a field goal if Irma goes right between Florida and Cuba. And they're now saying it's going to be a 5+. In fact, they may come up with a new category, a category 6, because it's shaping up to be the most powerful storm ever seen.
I mean, it just can't happen, right? We got to pray that that does not happen. I remember the similar warnings when Rita was headed towards Houston.
2 weeks after Katrina, right?
Yeah. And it was, at the time, it was, when it was out at sea, it was the strongest hurricane ever measured. And so they were talking, we might have to come up with a new category, like a 6 or a 7 for this thing. Well, it fortunately petered out a little bit and was only a 3 by the time it veered off and hit Beaumont. So anything can happen with these things, and you just got to hope and pray this doesn't come anywhere near Houston again. Jeez, that would be devastating.
Anywhere near land. Things are, hopefully, I mean, the best thing is it would just spin off north before.
And that could happen. It could go northeast.
But they're
right?
It could. They're getting close enough now where they're starting to really think it's going to hit Puerto Rico and Florida.
And we're talking about Puerto Rico being just, if it is as strong as they think it is, Puerto Rico would just be wiped off the face.
Yeah, there was a report earlier that said that they may not have power for 6 months in certain areas.
6 months?
God, that's your entire civilization turns off at that point.
Yeah, and if you have you been to Puerto Rico?
I have not.
It's not that big. Yeah. It's really not that big. You go to Puerto Rico and you're like, this is it? I mean, this is all of it, right? To not have power in, you know, on an island that small is pretty remarkable. And what does that mean for the people of Puerto Rico? What does it mean for that culture? What does it mean for the United States? What does it mean for the economy of the world? What, I mean, holy cow.
It's amazing. We had 12 years without one of these things making landfall in the United States.
Two of them possibly back to back. Giants.
And they look horrible. You really spoiled by it, because as soon as this stuff comes back, you realize it really does send that signal of how insignificant you feel.
Yeah.
You have no control over your life.
As I was shoveling literally the remains of a woman's life in a, you know, snow shovel, and I was throwing it out on the front lawn, I thought, our lives, the stuff that we collect, the stuff that we think is important, absolutely meaningless. Just each other. That's all that counts.
Mercury.